All right, welcome back to episode 239 of the I Love Kelowna podcast. Today I'm with Stephanie Heiser. She is in Visalia, California, and I lived in California myself, and I visited there many times, and I had not heard of Visalia before. So this is a very interesting conversation. Stephanie became a realtor, and in her first year, she did 54 transactions. This is an amazing story of growth, of extremely hard work, but at the same time, having a balanced life and enjoying herself and not completely burning herself out, even though she got into the land development business, property renovation business, and drastically underestimated what it would cost to renovate something. But she learned from it, and she still turned a profit, and she did 54 transactions in her first year. Now, when you see Stephanie and you listen to her, she is a young, strong, powerful woman, and I was surprised to find out that she suffered from some serious health issues. So we talk about that. We talk about, how do you do 54 transactions in your first year as a brand new agent and still have an awesome life with lots of fun, dealing with health issues, dealing with financial setbacks, and getting through all of that? So a very inspirational story, Stephanie Heiser. Let's welcome Stephanie to the show right after this.
Kelowna, one of the most beautiful places in the world to live, surrounded by provincial parks, pine forests, vineyards, orchards, and mountains. Wouldn't it be great if there was a podcast about our love of Kelowna? Oh no, it's real. This is I Love Kelowna, an interview-style podcast about the fabulous and fascinating people that make up our great city and the Okanagan. Intimate conversations with entrepreneurs, executives, thought leaders, creatives, and anyone who has an interesting story to tell about how they're contributing to our wonderful home. This is I Love Kelowna, and here's your host, Luke J. Minkus.
Hi, Stephanie. It's great to see you this morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
Great. So you're in a town called Visalia, California. I haven't heard of it before. Where is that approximately?
Visalia is in Central California. We're about 40 miles south of Fresno and about 40 miles west of Sequoia National Park. And we're like 130,000 people. I guess we're at 150,000 now. We have a lot of people moving from the Bay Area and LA.
Okay. So it's very similar to the size of my town. It's about 150,000. And we've got a lot of people moving here from Vancouver, which is Canada's second largest city. And we're both in real estate. Did you always live in Visalia or did you move there later?
I moved to Visalia in February this year. I had lived there 10 years ago. I was a teacher and I had applied all over the state and just ended up wherever I could get hired. And when I was looking for a place to rent, like right in front of the rental office, I remember it so clear. It was just a beautiful, cloudy autumn day, and all the oak tree leaves were falling and the church bells were ringing, and I felt like I was in a Hallmark movie. I grew up in the desert in 29 Palms, and so moving to a town with fall leaves and a cute, quaint main street, it just felt so amazing. It just really brought me to life.
Mm. So you decided to move there?
Yeah. So point? I taught there for a year, got laid off like every year for teaching. Basically, all of us that were newbies got laid off and moved a whole bunch of places. I was always in love with Visalia. I moved there a second time in 2017, I believe, and I got a different teaching job there But then unfortunately, my dad had like his arm got paralyzed. So I moved back home to 29 Palms, Joshua Tree, and ended up staying here for a few years. But when I became self-employed and started real estate last year, I just had this idea that I had to be back in Visalia. And when I lived there the second time, my brother moved up there with me and he met a girl and eventually had a baby, and they have the cutest 2-year-old ever. So my mom and I just one day decided we're both moving. And when my dad retires in December, he'll move up there with us.
Nice. So you mentioned Joshua Tree. I know that national park, but are there actually people who live there?
Yes, especially now our population, I swear, has like doubled in the last year. So I grew up in 29 Palms, which is a Marine Corps base. It's the largest base land-wise in the world. Wow. And I grew up on the military base. We are like 15 minutes from Joshua Tree National Park. And Joshua Tree is just absolutely special. If you guys haven't been there or don't know what it is, search it, because it is really magical. You can see every single star. You can see the Milky Way very often. It's a truly special place. And last year during the pandemic, I think everyone from LA and San Diego wanted to move to a rural community. Mm-hmm. And our prices have gone up 62% in the last year.
Wow. Wow. So you've been in real estate about a year. How did you decide to get into real estate?
It's been about a year and a half, and I really just felt like the education field was way too toxic for me. It's just beating the life out of me. And so basically I quit my vice principal job and had my husband, who was not my husband at the time, but I had him sell his house and move in with me so that I could afford to cut my salary in half and like salvage my sanity. And so that was kind of our first taste of real estate leading to financial freedom. From that sale, he paid off all of his student loan debt, and then we had extra money to invest. So we bought a 400 square foot cabin on 5 acres. And yeah, that holds a special place in my heart. But we were flipping it, and you know, we got an estimate from a contractor that it would be $25,000 of work, and it was $100,000 of work. So for like a year, it was a lot of blood, sweat, and a lot of tears and a lot of learning. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I just thought like, oh, I have to get my license. Like, I had reached out to an agent that sold another tiny cabin for like $192,000. And I was like, how did you do this? Mm-hmm. And he was so, so sweet, so generous. And he told me, like, why don't you just get your license and sell it yourself? And from that day, it just became an obsession. And I got my license. And, you know, I really love to educate and advocate. Like, that is my passion. So in real estate, especially with my experience with my cabin and that agent not telling me I would have to go through the new build process, even though the structure exists, but it was built before the single family residence permit was a thing. So to get an SFR, I had to do the whole new construction. So I learned about architects and engineers and percolation test and installing septic tanks and became like the cabin queen. So it was, you know, a painful, annoying time, but it, of course, just became the catalyst for a whole new life for us.
Yeah. I want to ask you, did the contractor lie to you, or did the contractor not understand the whole process of getting an SFR?
Exactly. The contractor is a good friend. We just love and respect him so much. He's excellent. And I always send people to him. And he just did not understand. Most people at that time didn't understand that all of our cabins are designated as a rec cabin, so a recreational cabin. And that's from the Homestead Act in the 50s, where if you built a little structure, you could get 5 acres. So they're scattered all throughout the desert. You'll see abandoned cabins, you'll see renovated cabins, and so it's just, you know, doing your due diligence. I feel like the agent should have known that it was permitted or like zoned rec cabin and not SFR, but also I should have known. But like, how do you know that when you're just a teacher and you've never been surrounded at all by anyone that invests in real estate? But it's all good now, because, you know, I spent $100,000 total on the cabin and sold it for $160,000. And that was when, like, we had the second wave of shutdowns. Airbnb was not being allowed at the time. Everyone, of course, was super freaked out about coronavirus. So if I held on to it a few more months, then I could have sold it for a lot more. But I was a rookie in real estate, and I just needed to unload this cabin because it was taking every single penny of our paycheck.
Right. Understood. I want to talk to you all about real estate, but tell us, what's the problem with the educational system in the United States? We have similar problems here, but I'd like to know your opinion. Like, why was it stressing you out so much? Why did you find it so toxic?
Well, honestly, if I just have like a passion for educational law and for special ed, and I feel like in a lot of the schools, I was at like 16 schools in my 17 years in education. So I got around. And so it was like a huge sociological study. And, you know, lack of funding, I don't think is so much the issue. I think it's misuse of funding. And, and, you know, we switched from having a holistic approach to focusing on testing way too much and took all the fun and joy out of teaching. I mean, I did my own thing anyway. I still did art and music and always, you know, brought in history and did all the fun stuff with my kiddos and did my own thing in my classroom. And of course, their test scores were incredible. We had huge success with doing it, you know, what I felt intuitively would be best for them. But, you know, then we got away from discipline and structure. And now, you know, kids just, you can't suspend them or you get a huge fine. You can't, you know, take away recess. And of course, there's pros and cons to all of that. I don't think, you know, we should just severely punish all the kids, but I definitely think we need a consistent discipline matrix. And, you know, you can love kids, but still teach them right from wrong. And when you send a kid to the office for fighting in class and they come right back to your classroom with a taco, it really sends a bad message to all the other kids. And your hands are tied. And even as a vice principal, like, I followed the discipline matrix. You know, I was giving the kids tough love and super close to them, and I loved them so much. But my admin, like, took me off of the special education. I was like the admin director of special ed in our school, and they just removed me from it because I let parents request testing, because, you know, if kids are tested and we learn their learning disabilities and help them, it's crazy how much they can do. So just after like one too many super depressing situations and then getting beat up by 6-year-olds, I was outro.
Makes sense. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other topic, and we could talk about that for hours, but Thank you for sharing that with us. So you did 54 deals in your first year. And you mentioned to me before we started the show that you were working 15-hour days, but how did you get so many clients?
Honestly, I hate saying it now because I know so many agents hate Zillow. And now that they're a broker, it's like a whole different ballgame. And I don't do Zillow anymore. I may start it, I mean, because I am in a new town and we do have an influx of people moving from other areas. You know, I've done it a little bit, but it's just not as successful in different areas. But in 29 Palms, especially because we're a military community and people are looking for homes from afar, and then plus all of the people from LA and other big cities that are investing here, Zillow was just killer. And I feel like, you know, people could pay for Zillow and not turn those leads, but I just knew my MLS. So every single morning, like, I would study what was new, what closed, how much did it close for compared to the asking price. And then I just started writing strategic offers. You know, I'd call the listing agent and say, hey, what does the seller want? Where are your offers? Of course, they don't tell you the offer price most of the time. And I'm on a mission to change that, because why is it a secret? If you've got an offer for $50,000 over asking already and my client can't even touch that, it's a waste of my time, your time, and my poor client gets their hopes up for nothing. So
I totally agree with you.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm really on a mission to change this. But just being strategic and knowing my market, knowing when people called, you know, like if they were thinking like, oh, I just want a brand new house and I don't want a bidding war, then I say like, okay, let's look at houses that aren't brand new, but they've been on the market for over 30 days. Like, let's, if you don't want a bidding war, you've got to be willing to sacrifice one of your wants. So strategy and anticipating the needs of others, and then just educating and empowering my clients so that they, you know, I earned their trust, and then I just like matched them with their house. It's like being Cupid.
Yeah. Right. That's the way we used to do it before computers. It was matching a buyer and seller. And this idea that everything has to be top secret, like if my client is in a real rush or they're having financial issues or things like that, I'm not going to disclose that. But if I got an offer that's $50,000 over asking, I don't see any harm in just letting people know, look, this is where we're at. And sometimes even on complex deals, I would get people in the room, buyer and seller, their agent, myself, and we just hash it out, get a notepad and we work it out. A lot of realtors are kind of like, no, no, you can't talk to my people. And they get really secretive and weird about it. So I think the key is for new realtors, if you have permission from your client, you can do a lot. You can say a lot, and you can really move the ball forward by just being open. But you got to get permission from your client. Yeah,
for sure. Being transparent, working together. And, you know, I always say, like, of course, my fiduciary duty is to my client. But first and foremost, for me, I feel like my duty is to, like, integrity and to doing what's right for everybody. I'm not going to, like, I hate when my clients want to lowball or try to squeeze everything out of the seller if we've kind of figured out that they're, you know, desperate to sell. Like, I'm not here to take advantage of people. I am not, like, that desperate for my next paycheck that I will compromise my integrity for anything.
So most American realtors know what Zillow is. A very few Canadian realtors know what it is. Explain to us how it works. It's a lead generation system, right?
Yep. Online lead gen. So Zillow, I would have to verify the data, but I'm pretty positive they're the number one site for people searching for homes for sale. So I've even had a few sellers approach me through Zillow, but you pay Zillow monthly, and the price is based on the average price point in your market, as well as how much other agents are paying. And in many markets, especially in San Diego, LA, the expensive areas, you would be paying well over $5,000 a month to even buy into it. And so many of your calls are absolute crap leads that are not buying a house, or they already have an agent. And Zillow gives you a CRM. You get to have all your conversations recorded so you can replay them if you can't remember. Message them through Zillow. I paid $625 my first few months, and then I was so busy and so addicted to like turning those deals. The most I ever paid in the Joshua Tree area was $950, and I was making $20,000 a month like all last year. So nice. It was absolutely worth it. And then on my data, it shows I had, I think it was like 512 something connections. So those are people like I talk to. So, and then I converted 10% of that, which, you know, most people don't realize your conversion rate for online lead gen. If you're at 5%, you're killing it.
So, what makes you, what do you think the reason is that you're able to double, you know, from 5 to 10%, what a good realtor is going to do 5% and you're doing 10%. What do you think the key differences are in your strategy?
I think that, you know, like I was saying, just knowing the market. When I got a phone call, I knew, like, I mean, obviously inventory is pretty low, so it's not super difficult to know all 30 houses on the market. But most likely have already shown that house or previewed it or talked to the agent to get more details. So when the phone rings, like I had the MLS pulled up right away so I could read the private notes and just be prepared. So you're multitasking when you get the call. I set the ringtone for Zillow to this like crazy loud obnoxious ringtone, and I made it like an emergency contact. So if my phone like was on silent or if I was taking a nap, it would ring and I would answer. And I mean, if I was at dinner, I just had to answer. Like I worked nonstop. You just have to answer the phone.
Yeah. So it actually rings through. So a person sees a button that says, do you want to talk to an agent? And they click that and it rings through.
Yeah. They request like information about a property or a tour. And then Zillow will connect with them, and then you'll get a phone call and it's like, hey, this is Roberta from Zillow. I have so-and-so on the line. They're looking at this property. And then now they've even changed it to where you can connect in the app and it pulls up the listing for you.
Nice.
So, I mean, they really make it easy for you, but now Zillow's transitioning to a flex program where you have to be invited by Zillow based on your call answer rate, based on your customer service rating. And they now are changing it to where you don't pay monthly, but you pay, I think it's a 35% referral fee with each closed transaction.
I see. That's interesting. So when you paid $625 a month, does that get you a certain number of leads? Like how do you determine the amount that you're spending?
On the Zillow website from the agent side, you can look at your zip code. And my sales rep was super strategic. I really loved working with him. He wasn't like super lame and salesy. He was strategic and said, all right, you could be number one and get, you know, for $1,000 and get all these phone calls, but let's just put you at number three for $650. Let's see how it works. So in my current market, to be in the top three, which means your face shows up as one of the top three agents in the market, your face shows up the third amount of times and you get the third most phone calls. So I would have to be at 1500 in my current zip code where I live in Visalia. And I was doing that, but now that I'm so immersed in the community and wanting to just do what really resonates with me, and to, I'm just on a hardcore mission right now to only do what I want when I want, and mm-hmm. to recover from the last decade of the massive amount of stress from teaching. And last year I was still like working full time in education until June 30th. So I was working full time with the most incredible homeschooling families ever, helping facilitate their learning and selling real estate. So thank God that job was online, because I would have never in my life imagined my real estate career would just take off so insanely fast. So mm-hmm. it's been a whirlwind. And now I'm like, you know what? I've paid off a whole bunch of student loan debt, and I just need to do what I want when I want. And, you know, Peter Lorimer is, he has the Real Estate Entrepreneur podcast that I have been obsessed with ever since I heard him talk about like being authentic and being true to yourself and bringing people into your sphere that resonate with you. So that's my new goal in life, just working with people that value and appreciate my input, I guess.
Yeah. That makes sense. So 54 transactions here would be about 5 years of experience for the average agent. And I would say even more so, because like over time we forget things, right? I don't remember everything I did 5 years ago or all the conversations I had. So when you can compress it into a year, like you've had so much experience, you know, getting trial close to a fire. Decade worth of average realtor experience, right? Yeah. Trial by fire. So what would you tell a brand new agent starting out today? What are some of your secrets for success? You mentioned, you know, only dealing with people that resonate with, only doing things you want to do. But someone starting out that needs that first deal, that second deal, do you recommend?
Forget all about doing what resonates with you. You've got to be ready to answer the call and jump at a moment's notice. You might think you're sitting down and watching football on a Sunday, but no, that phone rings, you're answering it, you're taking it. I think for a new agent, they absolutely should be studying the MLS, knowing what's available, what prices they're looking at, what has closed, the difference between the asking price and the closing price, and, you know, networking with other agents, building rapport, building connections. And, you know, you have to do what resonates with you and what makes you, like, if you can genuinely cold call, get red X and dial all day, every day. I never want to do that in my life. My teammate, Michael, like, I purchased it for my team because my agent, Michael, he's an incredible guy, so awesome at connecting with strangers. He will dial every day and have great success. I will never do that, but more power to him.
Yeah, it takes all types. Tell us what Red X is, just briefly, for those who don't know.
It is a program that gives you owner information. It will separate to absentee owners if you just want to target people that have rentals and maybe want to cash out in this high market. And it's an auto dialer that you can just sit at your computer with your headphones on and call a million people and get cussed out and hung up on, and maybe connect with one amazing person that just really needed that phone call that day. You never know.
Yeah. Takes a real special kind of person to do the cold calling. And I agree with you. It's not me, but if you've got someone on your team that's good at that, that's awesome. Really awesome. Now, you obviously give a lot of advice to clients, right? What do people need to know when they buy their first investment property? So you made some mistakes and you learned a ton from the experience with the cabin. Someone wants to buy an investment property. What are some of the things that you tell them?
If they're buying an investment for a short-term rental, I tell them call the city or the county, whichever jurisdiction is in charge of your short-term rental permits, and find out, are they still allowing short-term rentals? Some cities have a cap on how many short-term rental permits they will issue. So find out if you can get a permit. There's websites such as AirDNA that will tell you the average price point in a certain market. You can also just go on Airbnb yourself and see what the prices are, see how many reviews these like highest priced homes are getting. Did they only rent it out to two people or to 500 people? You know, a lot of people think the Airbnb market is super saturated, but I mean, every weekend that I was showing houses in Joshua Tree, the investors themselves would see and say, like, man, I just paid $600 a night for a rundown place. Like, I'm going to buy this super nice house and get at least that for it. So you got to immerse yourself in the experience. Like, do you want to just have, you know, a cheaper home with a cheaper price point? That totally works too. If you calculate your ROI and you're getting a good enough cash flow to make it worth your stress, like, go for it.
Yeah, totally. And I think, like you said, it's a good idea to invest in properties that you would be comfortable with. Because I think, like, I've invested in properties where, you know, it's a little bit rough. The rate of return was really good, but I couldn't really relate to the people that lived there. You know, they had issues and problems that were just frustrating for me. So since then, I've always tried to invest at a level like where would I live there? And it doesn't have to be super luxury, but, you know, when I was younger and more lower middle class, like, would I be comfortable in a place like this, right? And I just find I can relate to the tenants much better, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. And also doing what resonates with you. Again, like, I have an investor that is strictly doing, like, maybe a B neighborhood, but he wants to give these homes to his children in the future. And he doesn't want the drama of the C and D and F neighborhoods. He wants, you know, the peace, the serenity, the beautiful yard, the beautiful pool. And, you know, he's waiting until he finds great deals. And when we find them, we jump on it. But, you know, some people love owning, you know, 8-unit buildings and the drama that comes with low income renting doesn't impact them. And if you're Section 8 and the government is paying your clients' bills, then that's like a guaranteed paycheck and you don't have to worry about them missing rent. So there's pros and cons to every single type of investing, which is what is so beautiful about real estate. Like, if you're an agent and you want to be independent and self-employed and do everything your own way, like me, there's that space for you. But if you want to, like, work in an office 9 to 5 and have your broker control your life and be your boss, you can do that too. There's brokers for that. As an investor, if you want to make a ton of money and own a bunch of short-term rentals, cool. If you want to flip houses, there's a market for that. If you want to own long-term rentals and be in it for the long run, there's a market for that. So you just have to do, like, what feels good to you.
Makes sense. And I agree with that, because if you are doing something you enjoy, you're much more likely to learn about it. You're going to pick up articles. You're going to pick up books. You're going to talk to people. When I'm excited about something, I want to learn everything I can. And learning is mandatory to be good at anything, right? So you might as well enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, it's cliche, but knowledge is power. It's so true.
Yeah. How does a buyer or an investor know if they're getting a good deal? How can you tell, especially if you're new at it?
Well, there are a lot of resources for calculating your ROI. So knowing your return on investment. And for some people, just buying a home and for the long haul, if you have a long-term rental and your cash flow is even $200 a month, that's a great cash flow. Like, you know, when I was dabbling in real estate investing and starting to learn all about it, I just assumed all these people made like tons of money every month on every house, but that's not true. And I mean, of course, now rents have gone up so high and sales prices have skyrocketed. So if you bought a home 5 years ago, your cash flow is huge right now. But just calculating your return on investment, you want to see what all your costs and fees will be. You're paying property tax, you're paying for a gardener if you need one, you're paying if the roof collapses. But is it worth it? And are you in a market that is going to appreciate over time? If you're only, quote unquote, making $100 profit each month on that home, but it's appreciating and you're going to sell it in 20 years and get all the money back that you've put into it, plus a whole lot more, like that's excellent. Like, you don't have to make $1,000 a month or $10,000 a month on a property for it to be worth it.
Yeah, totally true. So, Stephanie, you've had some health issues. You've got something called Hashimoto's. Did I pronounce that correct?
Yes, Hashimoto's is a thyroid disease. It's an autoimmune disease. So I have a really big thyroid. It looks like, I don't know, a giant Adam's apple. But my thyroid has also been really high before. Now it's consistently low. So it just, it's different for everyone that has thyroid issues. But I've had, I mean, one time I went down the list and had like 99 of the 110 symptoms that were listed. So I've had days where it was really, really difficult to walk 2 feet. And it impacts your hormones. So that impacts, you know, your hair. Sometimes I'll have like gobs of hair falling out. Sometimes my face like gets a lot more peach fuzz than normal. Most of the time it manifests for me as like severe like panic attacks or anxiety. And lately it's been trying to come through as like a really heavy depression. So sometimes you'll get brain fog, and it's just so important to take care of yourself. And I did not do that for the last year. I mean, I got out of education, which was a really, really healthy choice. I mean, real estate comes with its own craziness.
Yeah.
But not having someone controlling me and being able to take the time off if I need to is life changing. I don't have to feel guilty for calling in sick. I don't have to be treated like absolute crap because I needed to go to 5 doctor's appointments this week. So being self-employed has been everything for me. And, you know, I'm trying. I'm failing at eating healthier, but with thyroid and autoimmune, you know, exercise and minimizing your stress and eating healthy makes a big difference.
Yeah. Some of those 15-hour days must have been a challenge, but you could reshuffle things and take a day off occasionally when you needed to.
Yeah, I think I should have taken maybe a few more days off, but I would go to the beach or go just go on a vacation and I would still work there. But I could work in bed in my pajamas on the computer, or I could sit at like on the sand, listen to the waves, got my hotspot on my phone and type contracts and schedule inspections. But moving forward, I want to actually take vacations and have a complete mental break. So now that I'm building a team, I plan to take one day off a week and just have a warning in my email signature. Like, if this is a Wednesday, I'm spending time with my family or myself.
Yeah.
And if it's an emergency, call, I don't know, whoever, my teammate, and just trying to turn it off. But I'm a workaholic. I love it. It doesn't stress me out. Like, I love problem solving, and real estate is a whole bunch of problem solving.
Yeah. Yeah, being a workaholic is a challenge, and it's a challenge for realtors, especially because, you know, if someone needs something or someone wants to see a house, it's really hard to say, no, I'm taking it easy today, get somebody else. Like, you're not going to do that, right?
No.
So one thing I've tried to do, and I don't know if it's useful to you, but is I work hard every single day because I'm a workaholic, but I try to take a vacation every single day. So what I mean is, I might take an extra 20 minutes if I'm out for coffee. If I go to the beach, instead of going for 20 minutes, I might go for 45 minutes, right? So I try to do something fun every single day because I'm not the kind of person that can sit at a pool bar in Mexico and just go get a beer and then go swim up and get another beer. Like, I'll go crazy. I can do that for a few hours. That's it.
Yeah, same. That's a great idea to just take a break every single day. I'm getting better at not answering work phone calls or emails after 8 o'clock is my goal. Mm-hmm. I have clients texting me at 5:30 in the morning, and I'm an early bird. And so, like, I want to answer right away and just get that off of my to-do list. Otherwise it's just on my brain. So I might as well do it and dump it. But I'm trying to train myself to have regimented hours. And, you know, when you're working a 9 to 5 or, you know, whatever hours teaching might have been, and then you transition into being self-employed, and if you're really busy and successful in your self-employment, it's so weird to, like, you don't want to say no to business and you want that business and you want to grow. But also, like, all day, every day, you're just working. And I don't even know when it's Monday or Friday or it's just I work, work, work.
Yep. No, I can totally relate. So what's the best way for people to follow you? You're an inspirational person. And I think especially for new realtors, you know, they want to have your level of success. What's the best way if people want to kind of follow you and keep up to date with what you're doing?
Well, I am on Instagram most of the time. It's Steph Heiser Does Real Estate. So STEPHHEISER Does Real Estate. My team page is Heiser Home Team. And I'm on Facebook. And they could also just look up my phone number and call me. I'm always, always down to help new people. And I, you know, I love just showing people the power of real estate. And every single person that gets their real estate license is not going to be a top agent. You have to hustle. You have to be genuine. You have to want it. Like, you've got to be hungry. But if you're reaching out and absorbing all of the information that's available in our days of technology, there's too much information. But if you just find what resonates with you, what sounds good, like if you find someone that seems like they're your type of people, like, reach out and just see. Like, I'm always happy to help anyone.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you very much for your time and for sharing all those stories. And you're obviously an extremely busy person, so we really appreciate the time you took today to talk to us.
Thank you so much. It was an absolute honor. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You've been listening to I Love Kelowna. We love where we live. And how can you not? With all the provincial parks, pine forests, vineyards, orchards, mountains. On each show, we have in-depth, intimate conversations with entrepreneurs, execs, thought leaders, and creatives, all that make up Kelowna. You can support the show so we can keep producing by going to paypal.me/Luke Menkes. And make sure to visit the official website at ilovekelowna.buzzsprout.com. We hope you've gotten some useful and practical information from the show. And we hope you had some fun along the way. We'll be back soon. Until then, this is I Love Kelowna, signing off.